This is the third day of this November 2010 seven-day session. We'll resume reading the autobiography of Zen Master Hanshan from the book The Practice of Zen, translated by C.C. Chang. We left off yesterday when he was 30 years old. He and his Dharma buddy Miao Feng had gone to Wutai, the famous Wutai Mountain, where he found himself in a kind of heavenly paradise of snow and ice. Both body and mind felt at ease and comfortable. After some time, Miao Feng left while I remained alone. I fixed my mind upon one thought and spoke to no one. This, what the translator makes thought, we don't know what that means. It could be a koan or something else. It can be sure it's not a thought in the ordinary sense of a discursive thought that would divide his mind. It's something else. It may be what in Japanese is called nen, which is just very difficult to translate. In our 10-verse Kanon Sutra that we chant, we make it moment. This moment arises from mind. This moment itself is mind. Other times it's translated as thought moment. In any case, we can at least conclude that his mind was single-minded. He was focused on this one thing and spoke to no one. If anyone came to the door, I merely looked at him and said nothing. After a while, whenever I looked at people, they appeared like dead logs. My mind entered a state in which I could not recognize a single word. At the start of this meditation, when I heard the howling of the storms and the sounds of the ice grinding against the mountains, I felt very disturbed. The tumult seemed as great as that of thousands of soldiers and horses in battle. Later, I asked Miao Feng about it. He said, "All feelings and sensations arise from one's own mind. They do not come from outside." Have you heard what the monks in the old days said? If one does not allow his mind to stir when he hears the sound of flowing water for 30 years, he will come to the realization of the miraculous understanding of Avalokiteshvara. Let's just rewind here and consider this, what Miao Feng told Hanshan. All feelings and sensations arise from one's own mind. They do not come from outside. This is something that you can remind yourself of when confronted with a disturbing makyo. Especially a frightening makyo. It's all mind. I then went to sit on a solitary wooden bridge and meditated there every day. At first I heard the stream flowing very clearly, but as time passed, I could hear the sound only if I willed it. If I stirred my mind, I could hear it, but if I kept my mind still, I heard nothing. One day, while sitting on the bridge, I suddenly felt that I had no body. It had vanished, together with the sound around me. Since then, I have never been disturbed by any sound. I would say that where he said here, I could hear the sound only if I willed it. I think many of us have had the experience, similar experience with vision while we're sitting. The eyes are open, but we're not seeing anything. Only if we momentarily decide to see the wall, only then do we see anything. Otherwise, there's nothing to be seen. It's all about attention, of course. It's like looking out the window of a plane, or just in one's own house, looking out in the yard. If your attention is on something else, well, you're not going to see what's right out there in front of you. We all know this experience. So if our attention is focused on our practice, then we're very often will not be aware of any visual perception at all in front of us. It'd be the same with thought, come to think of it, with all the senses. You know, in Buddhism, thinking is considered a sixth sense in addition to the usual five that we know of. If we don't allow our attention to dwell on thoughts as they arise, they're not there. This is what Hakuin means in the chant that we do, right? Just did a minute ago and before every Taisho. Our thought now being no thought. Our sight being no sight. Our hearing being no hearing. And of course with the other senses, feeling. This is how we transcend pain, by just keeping the mind absorbed in the practice. Same with smell, of course. There is this convention in Zen that if you're burning incense, you really only need to burn half a stick because after a while you don't smell it anyway. You become it. You're enveloped in it. Same with any smell. When we first encounter it, walking into a room or walking outside, well, there it is. But then after a while, it kind of disappears from our awareness. Still, one of the priorities in my mind when we designed this Sesshin complex was to be sure that the kitchen was a good distance from the Zendo. At Arnold Park, we would have the aromas of lunch and dinner wafting through the Zendo. It's nice not to have that additional distraction now when we're out here. My daily food was a gruel of bran, weeds, and rice water. Speaking of food, bran, weeds, and rice water. When I first came to the mountain, someone had given me 3 pecks of rice, which lasted for more than 6 months. One day, after having my gruel, I took a walk. Suddenly I stood still, filled with the realization that I had no body or mind. all I could see was one great illuminating whole, omnipresent, perfect, lucid, and serene. It was like an all-embracing mirror from which the mountains and rivers of the earth were projected as reflections. When I awoke from this experience, I felt as clear and transparent as though my body and mind did not exist at all. Whereupon I composed the following verse. Suddenly the violence of mind stops. Inner body, outer world, both are transparently clear. After the great overturn, the great voidness is broken through. Oh, how freely the myriad manifestations come and go. Well, this is the fundamental experience. Fundamental insight is the emptiness of all phenomena, including even one's own body. Now, we already read of his earlier awakening, but of course in Zen it's recognized that one can have multiple awakenings, and each one deeper than the previous one sometimes. Hakuin reports having had 18 major awakening experiences and lesser ones, too many to count. From then on, both the inward and the outward experience became lucidly clear. Sounds, voices, visions, scenes, forms, and objects were no longer hindrances. All my former doubts dissolved into nothing. When I returned to my kitchen, I found the cauldron covered with dust. Many days had passed without my knowing it. We're talking here about a very profound samadhi state and a very long-lasting one. In the summer of that year, Xuan Lang came from the north to visit me, but he stayed only one day because he could not stand the cold and gloom of my isolated hermitage. In October of 1576, my patron, Mr. Hu, invited me to stay at his house. His friend, Mr. Cao, asked me to write a poem for him. I said, "There is not a single word in my heart now. How can I write you a poem?" However, both of them pressed me, and after their repeated insistences, I could not refuse. What is that old saying? The man who pays the piper calls the tune. I then glanced over some old and contemporary books of poetry to stimulate my thought. In casually turning over the pages, my mind suddenly became keyed to inspiration. Verse poured from me, so that a few minutes later, when Mr. Hu returned, I had written some 20 poems. Suddenly I became aware of the danger of this and warned myself. Watch out, this is just what that devil in words, your habitual thought, is doing to you. Immediately I stopped writing. I gave one of the poems to Mr. Cao and kept the rest of them secret. Nevertheless, I could not seem to stop the creative outflow I had started. It was as though all the poems, books, or sayings I had ever learned or seen in my life appeared simultaneously before me, cramming the space and air. Even had I had thousands of mouths all over my body, I could not have exhausted the word flow. I did not know what to do. And then I'm going to now to summarize this next paragraph. It's quite long, and just in the interest of time, it occurred to him that this experience he was having, with his mind clogged with words and verses, is just what this previous master had called the Zen sickness. And he realized he was right in the midst of it. And he was alone. So there was no one there who could do anything. So the only thing he could do was to sleep. Sleep as long and deeply as he could. He tried different things and he finally fell asleep. A little later, the servant boy knocked on the door but couldn't rouse me. He tried to open the door, but he found it locked. And the boy went and got the Mr. Who, the patron. He got the boy to break in through the window. And they couldn't. They tried shaking him. They couldn't get him out of his trance. And then they spotted a small bell on a table and remembered that Hanshan, had once told them that it was used in cases of emergency to wake a yogi from a deep trance. So they began tinkling the bell next to his ear, striking it lightly many times. Gradually he began to awaken. When he opened his eyes, he didn't know where he was or what he was doing in that position. I guess he was still in the lotus position. And then his patron said to him, "Since I left the other morning, your reverence has been sitting in this room. That was 5 days ago." At which he said, "Oh, I thought only a single breath of time had passed." And then he began, you know, putting the world back together again as he sat there. He said, "Whatever had troubled me had vanished like rain clouds before a clear sky. All space seemed as clear and transparent as if it had just been thoroughly washed. All images and shadows dropped away into the great, all tranquil voidness. My mind was so empty, the world so serene, my joy so great that words could not describe it." I then composed the following verse. Well, he didn't run out of words entirely. "When perfect stillness reigns, true illumination is reached. Since serene reflection includes all space, I can look back on the world again, which is filled with nothing but dreams. Ah, today I really understand how true and faithful is the teaching of the Dharma." And I'm going to continue summarizing now. When he was 34 years old, he devoted himself to copying sutras. This was a practice in its own right in ancient China. With every stroke of the character and every mark of punctuation, he recited the Buddha's name once. And his visitors... When the visitors came, he would talk with them while doing this. This may have been one of the first cases of multitasking. "I would talk with them while carrying on my work of copying. If anyone asked a question, I answered without hesitation, yet my work was never hindered, nor did I make any mistakes in copying because of conversation." He did this every day as a routine, and not a trace of activity or quietness existed in his mind. This surprised some neighbors who were skeptical, and they came and they tried to distract him while he was working. And they showed him, he showed them the copying he did, and they didn't find a single mistake. And they all marveled at this. And Mao Feng just commented, "Oh, this is nothing. It is simply because my friend is well acquainted with this particular samadhi. That is all." Uh, this reminds me of the states of great, great clarity and fluidity that one can reach later in Sesshin, where we can just find ourselves moving and responding with just remarkable ease and effectiveness. I'm sure there are others here who have had this experience. It just reveals what great capacity we have and how marvelously the mind can function when it's not clogged with thoughts. And there are three pages of him recounting these elaborate dreams that he had, which I'm going to skip. I know from having heard Roshi Kaplow read this material quite a few times that although it's quite fascinating to hear these dreams, that it really didn't do me any good in my practice, and I don't see that it would do anyone else any good either. Oh, maybe there are people who would find some kind of inspiration from it, but I'm going to go with the orthodox Zen teaching of just leaving dreams alone, just trying to take care of consciousness, our conscious functioning. When I was 36 years old, I vowed to call a great congregation for Dharma. In the same year, Miao Feng wrote the complete Avatamsaka Sutra with his blood. He also wanted to form a non-discriminating congregation for Dharma. Non-discriminating, I should think, means a kind of ecumenical, all the different schools of Buddhism. For this purpose, he went to the capital to raise money. In a short while, he had not only secured the money and provisions needed, but had also invited 500 well-known masters and monks from all over the country to attend the congregation. Now here's where we go venture again into the dubious. All administrative matters, such as preparing the supplies and provisions, the quarters, and so forth, were handled by me alone. I was so occupied that I had no chance to sleep for 90 days and nights. On a certain day in October, Miao Feng arrived with the 500 monks. Altogether, the congregation, inside and out, numbered about 1,000 people. Their accommodations, supplies, and food were all in good order. No shortage or discrepancy occurred during this gathering. Those of you who were helpful in putting on the symposium we had, these symposiums we've had in the spring, or the meeting, the annual meeting of Zen teachers that we had here in July, might wonder how this could have been possible. In the first 7 days, we held a great prayer convocation for sentient beings of the waters and lands. During this time, I did not eat even a single grain of rice, but only drank water. Well, that's certainly doable for 7 days. I've done it myself. Each day I took care of changing 500 tables of offerings to Buddha, all in perfect order. People wondered how I could do it. They believed that I must have had some magic power. But actually, I knew that I was able to do this through the blessing of Buddha. When I was 37 years old, I taught the Hua Yan philosophy for 100 days. Listeners came from the 10 directions to hear my talks. Every day, the audience numbered over 10,000. We all ate at the same time and place, but no one made any noise or uttered a sound while eating. Whew. Everything in these meetings was conducted by me alone, thus exhausting my life energy. After the convention, I checked the treasury. Some 10,000 units of money remained, which I handed over to the temple. I then went away with Miao Feng, taking nothing with me but a begging bowl. After a long period of traveling and working, when I was 41 years old, I was able to reside quietly in a newly constructed meditation lodge of my own. Both my mind and body relaxed so that I began to feel wonderfully happy. One evening during meditation, I clearly saw the great illuminating whole, pellucid, transparent, void, and clear like a limpid ocean. Nothing at all existed. Whereupon I uttered the following verse. The limpid ocean shines clear and void, bright as moonlight, mirrored in white snow. No trace of men or gods remains. Oh, when the eye of Vajra opens, the mirage disappears. The great earth vanishes into the realm of tranquility. The eye of Vajra. Vajra means diamond, and the eye of Vajra would mean the our enlightened eye. After this experience, I returned to my room. Upon my desk lay the Sharangama Sutra. Casually, I opened it and came across the following sentences. You will then see that both your body and mind, together with the mountains, rivers, space, and earth of the outward world, are all within the wonderful, illumined, and true mind. Suddenly, the gist of the whole sutra was clearly understood in my mind and appeared vividly before my eyes. Whereupon, I dictated a thesis called The Mirror of Sarangama, within the time measured by burning half a candle. I had just finished when the meditation hall opened. Calling the administrative monk in, I let him read the thesis I had just written. As I listened to his reading, I felt as if I were hearing words from a dream. You know, even though few, if any of us, would have many of these experiences he's describing, I think many of us can resonate to the tone, to the sort of the quality of changes that he describes, that he went through, the changes in perception, the dreamlike quality of things. This is something that is not unusual to experience, even in Sesshin. Not to this depth and vividness that he describes, but we come to discover in Sesshin that the mind, everything's determined by the mind. Our whole experience of reality changes as the mind changes. The things are not as set as we normally think, that everything is in a sense we've come to find what neurologists are increasingly becoming aware of is that we interpret reality. There's no reality out there apart from us. It is a a communion. There is what we call reality as some abstract thing is how we interpret it. Can get very, very fascinating as we get these little glimmers, doing lots of zazen, many hours of zazen a day. We come to discover, in other words, that things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. You can't really tease apart mind and objects, mind and world. In 1589, I was 44 years old. In this year, I began reading the complete Tripitaka. The Tripitaka literally means the three baskets, and it refers to the three divisions of the Buddhist canon. There are the sutras, which are mostly the discourses attributed to the Buddha. There are the shastras, which are all of the later commentaries on the sutras and other texts by later masters. And then there is the Vinaya, the rules and regulations. The third one is not the Vinaya, but the Abhidharma, or in Pali, the Abhidhamma, which is all of the psychological and philosophical interpretations of the Dharma. Vast, we're talking about hundreds or I think even thousands of volumes. So we began reading the complete Tripitaka. Also, I lectured on the Lotus Sutra and on the Awakening of Faith. And now comes the final chapter in this autobiography. Ever since I left the Wutai Mountain, I had thought of visiting my parents, but I was afraid of being blinded by worldly attachments. Remember that in traditional Buddhist monks were expected to renounce their family ties. That's why they were called home leavers. As well as taking vows of celibacy. But here he seemed to feel that he was advanced enough in his practice that he might get away with visiting them. So, to go on, I was afraid of being blinded by worldly attachments. I then carefully examined myself to determine whether I would be able to visit my parents. One evening during meditation, I casually uttered the following stanza. Waves and ripples flow in the cool sky. Fish and birds swim in one mirror. On and on, day after day. Last night the moon fell from the heavens. Now is the time to illumine the black dragon's pearl. And there's a footnote here. The black dragon, according to an old Chinese legend, under the jaw of a black dragon there lies a most precious pearl. Hence the term Li Lung, black dragon, symbolizes the most precious thing to be found in the world. In other words, our true mind. At once I called my attendant and said to him, "Now I can return to my native land to see my parents." The Temple of Gratitude in my home district had, for some time, been applying for the gift of a complete set of the Tripitaka. In October, I went to the capital to make an appeal for my countrymen. A complete set of the Tripitaka was granted by the emperor as a gift. I escorted the sutras from the capital to Lungchang, arriving at my home temple in November. And then he describes some miraculous events, and rainbow bridges stretching from the heavens, and so I'll just skip that. Meanwhile, my old mother had heard of my coming. She sent messengers to ask me when I would visit my home. In reply, I said that I had been sent by the court to escort the sutras, not to just go home. However, if my mother could see me in a pleasant manner, without grief or sorrow, as if I had never left her, then I would stay for 2 nights. When my mother heard these words, she exclaimed, "This is an unexpected meeting, like finding someone of yours in another incarnation. Overwhelmed with joy, how would I find time for sorrow? Oh, I shall be quite content to see him, if only for a little while. 2 nights at home is far more than I had expected." When I reached home, my mother was overjoyed. She showed no sign of grief whatsoever. In her, I beheld only joy and good cheer. This surprised me very much. I'm thinking of little clips I've seen on TV of family members in Korea, in the two Koreas, North Korea and South Korea, who've been separated for 40 or 50 years, being reunited after not having seen one another for all those years, and what profound joy, grief, all mixed together, that they show, with the cameras in their face, of course. In the evening, the elders from among our relatives came in. One of them asked, "Did you come by boat or by land?" This is a koan. This is how the opening line in the koan in the Shoyu Roku, where the one master asks the other, "Did you come by boat or land?" And the other one says, "By boat." And the first one says, "Where is the boat?" And the second one says, "In the river." And then the one who was asking the questions, after the other guy left, he said, "Tell me, does this monk have an open eye or not?" That's the gist of the koan. "So did you come by boat or by land?" My mother immediately answered him, "What do you mean, come by boat or by land? What I really want to know is from where did he come home?" That was the first guy who was asked one of the elders who asked the question. "What I really want to know is from where did he come home?" My mother replied, "From the void he returns to us." And then Hanshan says, "I was surprised to hear her speak so. In my astonishment, I said, no wonder this old woman could give me away to the priesthood." I then asked her, "Have you thought of me since I left home?" She said, "Of course, how could I not think of you?" I then asked, "But how did you console yourself?" She replied, "At first I did not know what to do. Then I was told that you were at the Wutai Mountain. I asked a priest where this was, and he told me it was just under the North Star. I then made obeisance to the North Star and recited the Bodhisattva's name. After this, I felt much better and thought of you no more. Later, I just presumed that you were dead. For me, no more prostrations, no more thought of you. Now I see you as if in another incarnation." The next morning, I visited the graves of my ancestors to pay my respects. I also chose the site for the graves of my parents. At that time, my father was 80 years old. I joked with him by saying, "Today I bury you and so save you the trouble of returning to this earth again." Saying this, I struck the ground with a pick. Immediately, my mother snatched it away from me and said, "Let this old woman do the grave digging herself. I don't need anyone to bother for me." She then began digging up the ground in a lively fashion. I remained at home 3 days. When the time for departure came, my old mother was still in a very cheerful mood. Not until then did I become fully aware that I had a very unusual woman for a mother. So I guess all's well that ends well between those two of them. And our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.